Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. It's said that there was a time Jimmy Hoffa was bigger than Elvis. Then, as if that weren't enough, in the next decade, he was better known than the Beatles. In any business, that's a high bar to climb over. But Hoffa, the longtime president of the largest and most powerful labor union ever, was a working stiff. Not very flashy, not very entertaining, not very smooth, but very busy. He was, for a time, somebody most everyone in this country had heard of. Some loved him, some loathed him, some feared him, and somebody killed him. But nobody was ever found to take the blame for his disappearance and likely murder, at least not legally speaking. The fingers have pointed, at one time or another, at mob guys from New Jersey, mob guys from Florida, mob guys from Chicago, mob guys from Detroit, mob guys from Philly, the Kennedys, though both John and Bobby were dead by the time he disappeared, the CIA, the FBI, his union enemies, his union friends, and one man who Hoffa treated like a son, and another who said he was Hoffa's closest friend. Let's just say he ran with a tough crowd. But Hoffa was a hard-hewn, self-made man who reshaped the relationship of unions to those who employed them, and thus had an almost incalculable impact on how America worked and how the working class prospered, how it found power and used it for its own purposes in the middle years of America's 20th century. You'd be hard-pressed to find agreement on how July 30th, 1975 unfolded for one perpetually prompt James Riddle Hoffa, by then 62 years old. FBI interviews subsequent to his disappearance would show that Jimmy spent the morning talking on the phone to various associates. Several of those men would say he was out of character that day, that something felt very wrong, but no one could pinpoint what. Jimmy left his house at around 1:15 p.m. He arrived early for a prearranged meeting with two mob bosses at the parking lot of the Maucus Red Fox in Bloomfield Township. The township is just outside of Detroit on Telegraph Road, a somewhat busy thoroughfare. The men were ostensibly in town for a big Italian wedding. The meeting was, by several accounts, supposed to occur at 2:30, but other accounts vary. So much so that Jimmy called his wife from a nearby payphone at 2:15, angry that no one had showed. Six people say they saw him waiting quite impatiently in the lot between 2:30 and 2:45. A few say they spoke to him. A separate guy says he talked to Hoffa by phone at 3:30, but that's largely been discounted. In any case, after this, Hoffa was never heard from or seen anywhere again. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Athena Club. I just got a new delivery of Athena Club. I had another brand handy, but I didn't want to use it, so I was counting down the days to shave, and now it has arrived and all is well in the world again. Now you might ask, geez, what makes Athena Club's razors so worth the wait? Well, I'll tell you, it's the water-activated serum surrounding the blade. This stuff is gentle on my skin, leaving it moisturized, super smooth, and bump-free. Plus, Athena Club refills are mailed to me, so I don't have to remember to put them on my shopping list, meaning that every time I grab my razor, I have a fresh blade handy. Unless, of course, I use them often enough to run out early, but that's on me. I should make my deliveries more frequent. Everything about Athena Club is convenient, right down to the magnetic hook. That means no more clutter in your shower, no more goopy blades, no more razor crashing down in the middle of the night, scaring you to death. The best part is the razor kit is only $10 and comes in your choice of handle color. They've got several options from chic black to neons and pastels. Both of mine are blue. Ready to upgrade your shaving experience? Switch to the best razor on the market and show your skin you care with Athena Club. Head over to athenaclub.com to try their award-winning razor and body products and get 20% off your purchase with code COTC at checkout. You can also find Athena Club razors at your local Target store. Trust me, you won't look back. Happy shaving. Jimmy Hoffa was born in Indiana, but his dad died when he was 7, significantly from hideous working conditions in a mine. Little Jimmy came to Detroit when he was 11, as his mom looked for work in the auto industry. He left school at 14 to work for a grocery store. It was a 60-hour-a-week gig, paying the boy $12, or a nickel an hour. It was 1927, so let's do some inflation calculation here. That's 88 cents an hour in today's money. Not great by any definition, but it was a start and a help to his mother. Then 1929 rolled around. Detroit was hit very hard by the Great Depression and stumbled badly. Except for those who lived on the shores of Lake St. Clair and the Grosse Pointes, like Henry Ford, or on Boston Boulevard, like the Dodges. Happy for the work he got unloading boxes at a Kroger warehouse for the night shift, 19-year-old Hoffa's eyes were nevertheless wide open to how labor, like the kind he was doing, was being exploited.
The work was grimy, it was tough, it didn't pay much, and all of those things caused Hoffa to think, this is no way to make a living.
That was industrial relations professor Merrick Master talking to Local 4 Detroit for a special on Hoffa. Though the Kroger gig paid 32 cents an hour, a big leap from the 5 cents Hoffa had earned at age 14, Hoffa couldn't abide the working conditions. He had an extremely abusive boss, firing people at will, and a company that only paid workers when they were actually unloading trucks. If the trucks didn't come, or were sporadic or infrequent, too bad. Sit and rot, was the management opinion. Hoffa took exception. Labor had no protection, no one to hear their grievances, and the rule of thumb was like it or lump it. So one very warm May night in 1931, when strawberries were delivered to the warehouse, Hoffa arranged so that they would not be unpacked. Sit and rot indeed. From Local 4 again.
The foreman demanded they get back to work, berating and threatening the crew. Young Jimmy stood firm and handed over a list of demands. With fresh fruit spoiling on the loading dock, Jimmy Hoffa won his first negotiation for the group that became known as the Strawberry Boys.
Once the boss came to the table, Hoffa negotiated a one-year deal that guaranteed at least partial pay and had the union he'd created recognized. Hoffa continued to work there until it became too difficult for him and his boss to coexist. And the following day, the Joint Council 43 of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters offered him a job at the local 299. He'd be paid solely with a small portion of the dues that members paid. So the more he brought in, the better he did.
His career as a union organizer was launched. American workers needed a leader, and they had found one.
He was 21 years old. The Teamsters were primarily truckers and, fortuitously, were on the cusp of growing by leaps and bounds as the country got easier to traverse and cities began to grow their daily need for every imaginable kind of good. Hoffa, as we said, was no pansy. You had trucks and you weren't unionized, he'd threaten to blow up your operation. Management fought back with hired thugs, usually with the men on the low end of the organized crime totem pole, because they knew how to knock heads. Things didn't get ugly, they got deadly.
In 1937, the threat of workers organizing led to a deadly confrontation on Memorial Day in Chicago. A crowd of protesting workers marched on Republic Steel Mill. A formation of Chicago police opened fire, wounding over 100 workers, killing 10.
Later that spring,
a group of UAW members were beaten outside Ford Motor Company's River Rouge complex in a confrontation known as the Battle of the Overpass. They were trying to hand out leaflets calling for better pay.
Now, you might be wondering, where were the police in all this? Well, they sided with management. In fact, business owners often hired off-duty police officers to bust up picket lines. So HAFA got tougher, people got hurt, union ranks swelled, power was shifting. As Jack Goldsmith noted in his extremely fine In HAFA's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth, HAFA's Detroit was an anomaly when it came to post-prohibition wise guys. The Detroit Mafia wanted control of prostitution and gambling and loan sharking and drugs, but getting in on the labor end of things wasn't that interesting to them, not even when the lucrative side of pension lending got started. They had other fish to fry, and maybe this was just a local fracas that they didn't want. Now, by 1937, HAFA was president of the local 299. Let me stop here and tell you a little bit about HAFA, the guy. He was short and stocky with a thick head of hair. He was a good Protestant and family guy who, many swear, never cheated on his fragile wife, Josephine, whom he met in 1936 while she was out walking a picket line outside the laundry where she was being paid 17 cents an hour. Of that meeting, HAFA once wrote, quote, "I felt like I'd been hit on the chest with a blackjack," end quote. When they married in 1937, he was 24, she was 18. Surprisingly, maybe, HAFA never smoked or drank. It was widely accepted, as noted, that he was also never unfaithful. Josephine, however, couldn't claim likewise. She struggled with alcohol and pill addiction, and at one time had an affair with Anthony Cimini, a Detroit mobster. It's said that HAFA tried to get Cimini killed by a Detroit capo, Joe Zarelli, but was not successful. He apparently let it go. Josephine did not suffer, at least from Jimmy's end, for her indiscretion. She was, after all, the mother of his two children, a daughter Barbara and a son James. Those two didn't see their father much. And Josephine's frailty, her alcoholism, and her much-discussed but poorly illuminated mental health made her a bit absent as well. It made for an odd family dynamic, to say the least. Now let's talk a minute about HAFA's other family, specifically Frank Sheeran and Chucky O'Brien, the latter of whom is sometimes described as HAFA's adopted son. Both Chucky and Frank professed to love Jimmy HAFA, in many cases vowing to do anything he asked. In most cases, they did. It's important to note, too, that they were both amoral. Both men were, to put a fine point on it, people HAFA would never have thought twice about getting into a car with on July 30th, 1975. These are two fascinating characters in their own rights, but I'm going to skip to what you need to know here. Chucky was born in 1933 and was still an infant when the father he'd been named after died. With his mother Sylvia, Chucky moved around a bunch, but spent summers in Michigan, sometimes at the lake with HAFA and his kids, fishing, hunting, doing stereotypical guy stuff. HAFA taught Chucky how to drive. He hauled him around to labor meetings. He was nice to him. With Chucky fatherless, this was like magic to the kid from KC. Another father figure to O'Brien was Detroit capo Tony Jacalone. As author Goldsmith put it, quote, "Since Chucky was a teenager, HAFA had been his love and his ambition, and Uncle Tony, his identity, his conscience, his protector," end quote. In case it's not clear, Chucky did indeed have father issues. But he also had a mother who was as hard as nails and, most importantly, was the link between organized crime and the labor leader. Sylvia arranged meetings between the mob and HAFA, helping him secure their help and, in turn, his largesse. If they learned to scratch each other's back, it was Sylvia who asked everyone to undress. If they found life with each other easy, she was the grease. She knew the game, she set the table. Josephine, as in HAFA's wife, was Chucky's mother's dearest friend, well, except when Sylvia would complain that Josephine was a pain in the ass. And when things unraveled for Josephine, it was Sylvia who, along with her son Chucky, took care of her. Frank Sheeran was a two-bit hustler from Philadelphia who became a hitman for organized crime, specifically for Philly Don Russell Bufalino and, later, for Jimmy Hoffa. He's the subject of Charles Brandt's book, I Hear You Paint Houses, that being a euphemism for, I hear you kill people for money. As the book jacket says, quote, Sheeran would rise to a position of such prominence that in a RICO suit against the Commission of La Cosa Nostra, the U.S. government would name him as one of only two non-Italians in conspiracy with the commission, end quote. I Hear You Paint Houses became the basis of the 2019 Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci movie, The Irishman. Sheeran was the Irishman. This is De Niro as Sheeran placating Pacino as Hoffa in a clip from the film.
Fuck it, let's go.
Oh, Jimmy, give it a chance. Give it a chance. Give it a few more minutes.
This isn't right. This isn't right. No. You don't do this. You don't keep a man waiting.
I know.
The only time you do is when you want to say something.
I know.
When you want to say fuck you.
They're old men in this scene, but they had met each other in 1957, back when Sheeran was hanging with people with names like Whispers, Fat Tony, and Skinny Razor. The two men took a liking to each other, and Sheeran started to paint houses for Hoffa, among other things. They grew tight, but there was pressure everywhere. Mostly, it was the expected kind, but some was the unexpected kind. Like from the brother of the man Hoffa had worked so hard to get elected President of the United States. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Cerebral. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. I just chatted with a new Cerebral therapist the other day, and sometimes you really just find someone who clicks. This one did for me. I wasn't sure at first what all I was going to talk about beforehand, but then once the session started, things just came pouring out of me. With Cerebral, you're not just a name or diagnosis. Your clinician seeks to understand your unique needs, goals, and experiences to shape your path forward. You'll have an expert clinician working alongside you to craft a treatment plan that is tailored to your individual goals. To get started on your path toward better mental health, Cerebral is giving our listeners 15% off their first month of online therapy, medication, or both. Get started at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code COTC. Make 2024 your best year yet. That's Cerebral, Cerebral.com/podcast and use code COTC. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. See site for details. Labor unions, of course, have historically supported Democrats. Their allyship rooted in the philosophy that everyday Joes and Janes should be protected by the government from abuse at the hands of the rich and powerful. As such, Hoffa supported JFK in his 1960 bid to become president. The alternative was a risk to unions. But Kennedy, and more specifically his brother Bobby, was a clear risk to Hoffa specifically. Dan Moldea, author of The Hoffa Wars.
Bobby Kennedy, to me, is the greatest crime fighter who's ever lived. When he was chief counsel of the Senate Rackets Committee, he was eating mafia guys for breakfast.
Now, Hoffa had control of the Teamsters, which meant he had control of an enormous amount of money, many millions in its pension fund. Hoffa had negotiated an employer-funded pension in 1955. It racked up $10 million its first year. In the next 10 years, it would take in $6 million a month. So yeah, it was a gold mine, and Hoffa used it like a bank. He loaned a lot of cash to the cash-strapped Dons, who in turn gave him the muscle he needed to get and keep everything and everybody in line. The Hoffa story is replete with threads that one can hardly keep straight because they shift so quickly. So if you're inclined to take notes, you might want to use colored highlighters to keep up. A primer. The Mafia had been under public scrutiny since 1950, when America was transfixed by Senate hearings held in 14 states. Big audience on this new thing called television. Now, because of the not remotely secret overlap between the Mafia and the Teamsters, Bobby had started looking into Teamster shenanigans in 1957. As the lead investigator of another Senate committee, Bobby took on Hoffa, and somehow, Hoffa bested him. A sampling.
Did you say that SOB, I'll break his back?
Who?
You.
After say to who?
To anyone.
If I give you a speech, I don't even know who I was talking about, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Mr. Hoffa, all I'm trying to find out, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm trying to find out whose back you were going to break.
Figure of speech.
Here's another in which Bobby asked Hoffa whether he had seen mobster Johnny Dio on the day Dio was believed to have ordered that acid be thrown in the face of a newspaper columnist named Victor Riesel. Riesel was permanently blinded in the attack, for which Dio was never convicted.
You can't remember 3 months ago whether Johnny Dio was in your room? The man who's under indictment for throwing acid in Victor Rizel's eyes?
I cannot remember whether he was or not, as I said it. Or was that period of time, and I just don't recall.
You can't remember what you talked about, and you can't remember whether he was in your room.
Wouldn't have been of anything of any importance, Mr. Kennedy, and I can't recall it.
Again, that was 1957. The McClellan hearings, as they were dubbed, lasted 270 days, after which Hoffa walked. He faced no charges. As testy as those exchanges with Bobby Kennedy were, just 2 years later, Hoffa likely worked with the mob, especially in Chicago, to make sure JFK got elected, figuring things would go easier for them all if he won. But then Bobby, as the U.S. Attorney General, went after Hoffa with a vengeance that included hundreds of illegal wiretaps. This is Marvin the Weasel Elkind, Hoffa's former driver.
He was a great enemy of Bobby Kennedy. It went beyond politics. They hated each other.
The Weasel just died last month at age 89, it's worth noting. R.I.P. Somehow during this time, Hoffa may have gotten tied up in the Bay of Pigs fiasco with a mixture of CIA and mob interest, flubbing an attempt to thwart Castro and return Cuban casino control to the Mafia. To some, that makes it quite reasonable to think that JFK's assassination might have been engineered by mafiosos. Now, I'm not sure how far this stuff went, but let me say, a lot of it does sound plausible, especially given that Bobby and all kinds of jurisdictions persisted. 13 grand jury investigations yielded no charges. At the very least, this all, to me, makes quite plausible the rumors that Hoffa didn't much mourn JFK when he died. It's reasonable to think he was probably at least relieved at the prospect that Bobby might be sidelined. Hoffa, meanwhile, was gaining strength. By 1964, he had nailed down the first nationwide contract for truckers. In a nutshell, it included the feds in a deal that allowed trucking companies to pass along costs to customers. Hoffa did it by employing the tools he had sharpened over various labor fights: bribery, extortion, side deals, kickbacks, threats, charisma, and collusion. His Teamster membership didn't really care, even if he had skimmed some cash for himself, because they were the winners in the end. Not a legal mess that was left over from when the Kennedys were in charge, Hoffa was finally convicted by a Tennessee jury, guilty on 2 counts of jury tampering. He went to prison in 1967, sitting out the rest of the decade stewing. While in prison, he met a mobster named Tony Provenzano. They became friends. Interestingly, on December 23, 1971, President Richard Nixon pardoned Hoffa on one condition, that his work with the Teamsters was now and forever over. Hoffa said sure, but he didn't mean it. And this was a big mistake. Huge. Former Assistant U.S. Attorney Keith Corbett.
So after Nixon pardoned him, and he found out he couldn't get back into the union, he was going to take every effort he could to do that. And in order to do that, he had threatened to reveal the mob's involvement with the Teamsters.
Because Hoffa wanted control of the union he'd made, he wanted the guy he had put forward to run it gone, gone, gone. Because this guy, this was Frank Fitzsimmons, turned out to be a weak son of a bitch who let the mob run everything. Hoffa started threatening. When they said let it go, he said, no thanks. When even his friends, guys like Russell Bufalino and Frank Sheeran, said back off, you're gonna get hurt, he would say, let him try it. I got friends, they wouldn't dare. Bring it on. Well, be careful what you ask for. A specific rift was brewing with Tony Provenzano, also known as Tony Pro, Hoffa's prison pal and the New Jersey crime boss who was the president of the Teamsters Local 560 in Union City. Part of the rift might have had to do with Hoffa not letting Tony Pro have access to his $10 million pension money, but it was more than that. According to FBI reports, Provenzano, per Mrs. Hoffa, had asked Hoffa for some help in a phone call in early July 1975. Hoffa told his wife he was not going to help his old friend. It was also reported that Hoffa asked Tony Pro for his help in getting his Teamsters job back, and the wise guy responded by saying he would yank out Hoffa's guts and do just as much to his grandchildren. In short,
Hoffa and Tony Pro had become bitter enemies.
And things were coming to a head. Anthony Jacalone, the Detroit capo, ostensibly trying to iron out the matter, set up a meeting with Hoffa on the afternoon of July 30th, 1975, at a Detroit-area restaurant. Hoffa wrote down on a slip of paper found later that he was meeting Tony and Pro at 2:30. The FBI would later make note in a Hoffa conference at FBI headquarters in January of 76 that Hoffa had resisted this meeting for a long time, but had relented for reasons unknown. Hoffa, as I said before, showed up early for the meet, waited impatiently, called his wife and complained about the no-shows, hung out a bit longer and visited with one or two people going into the Maccas Red Fox between 2:30 and 2:45. Side note, you had to wear a coat and a tie to get into the restaurant, and Hoffa was dressed casually, so it's a sure bet he never went in, staying in the parking lot as prearranged. Crimes of Centuries is sponsored by Laundry Sauce. I ran out of laundry sauce and I really, really missed it. I just got my new shipment this week and there's no denying just how in love I am with how this stuff smells. Sounds weird, right? Well, it's true. I have two stinky dogs in my house and there's just something really relaxing about pulling out fresh clothes that smell like Egyptian rose. Now that's my scent and I'm sticking to it. If that's not your bag, you have plenty of scents to choose from. There's Australian sandalwood, cyberpine, Egyptian rose just happens to be my favorite. But there's more to like about Laundry Sauce than how it smells, and that includes the fact that it doesn't come in one of those big plastic jugs that end up in a landfill. Laundry Sauce was started back in 2021 by a team whose members were bored by the mundane scents in the detergent aisles, so they decided to make their own product. And that didn't just mean detergent pods. Laundry Sauce makes scent boosters, dryer sheets, dryer balls, and fabric softeners too. Remember, when you smell your best, look your best, and feel your best, you're ready to take on the rest. So head to laundrysauce.com/COTC and use promo code COTC at checkout for 15% off. That's the best offer you'll find, but you must use my code COTC for 15% off your order. One last time, that's laundrysauce.com/COTC, promo code COTC for 15% off. His 1974 green Pontiac was found in the parking lot the next day. Three witnesses said they saw him get into a maroon car, with three guys already in it, the prior afternoon. Hoffa's family started the process of trying to track him down. Josephine and son James filed a missing persons report. A $200,000 reward for information about the disappearance was offered. In the coming days, the FBI got involved, issuing a copious amount of notes, witness statements, suspect lists, suspect alibis, theories, and suppositions about where Hoffa went and whether he was still alive. Nothing came of it. Read One headline on August 1st, "No trace found of missing Hoffa." That was above an Associated Press story that quoted Michigan Governor William Milliken. So you can see that this was a high-profile case straight away. In the story, the governor said Hoffa had set off to meet Tony Jacalone, but Jacalone told the AP, quote, "That's absolutely untrue," end quote. Over the next 2 weeks, more than 100 newspaper stories just in Michigan mentioned Hoffa. Many newspapers in the state dedicated multiple full-page spreads to his disappearance. The Times-Herald, where I worked in the early aughts, had headlines like these on August 10, 1975. FBI investigating blood in O'Brien fish delivery. Did Hoffa have money in coal? Fitzsimmons, no comment. That last piece's headline is nonsense because in it, Frank Fitzsimmons, the guy Hoffa had picked to be his successor for the Union presidency but who had become his bitter rival in the months before his disappearance, commented plenty. He told a reporter who accosted him while golfing in Dallas, quote, "I have no idea where he is. I couldn't guess," end quote. Asked about reports of underworld involvement in Hoffa's disappearance, Fitzsimmons got even more verbose, saying those theories were, quote, "a bunch of bullshit. What would the underworld have to do with this? I don't know where you guys get all this," end quote. Stories like this continued day after day, week after week, month after month. My former Detroit Free Press colleague David Ashenfelter talking to Detroit Channel 7.
Yeah, this case was a very big deal. It was a huge story. People were out with shovels digging when Jimmy Hoffa disappeared.
The theories about what happened began percolating straight away. Detroit Free Press columnist Neil Rubin talking to this episode's lead writer, Amy Wilson.
He's supposedly beneath a swimming pool or on a farm way west of town, or he was fed into a metal smelter.
6 months after the disappearance, the big FBI Hoffa conference concluded that Chucky O'Brien, who was in debt to Tony Pro for a large sum of money, had had a run-in with Hoffa a year earlier because he desperately wanted to run Local 299, but Hoffa had refused to help him. They also concluded that Chucky was one of the few people Hoffa would have trusted to take him elsewhere in a separate car. Chucky denied he had any part in the disappearance. The FBI acknowledged that he may not have known that Hoffa would be killed when O'Brien delivered him to some unknown location. Charles Brandt posited in his 2004 book that Chucky was the driver of the maroon car witnesses described Hoffa climbing into. It was a Mercury Marquis, Brandt wrote, borrowed that day from Tony Jacalone's son. It's Frank Sheeran's story that he himself was responsible for pulling the trigger just minutes after Hoffa was picked up, driven to a nearby home, and shot in the head twice while both were in the foyer. Hoffa's body was then dealt with by a team of young mob guys who Sheeran said cleaned up the mess and drove Hoffa's body to a crematorium, and that was that. Sheeran supposedly did this on Russell Bufalino's immediate order, as directed by others, approved by others, and assigned to him because he was someone whom Hoffa, again, trusted. And because, well, Hoffa had been warned. All the suspects, save O'Brien, had terrific alibis, even Sheeran. The FBI has never had anything they could pin on anyone. On September 8, 1975, a federal grand jury investigating Hoffa's death had both Tony Provenzano and Tony Jacalone appearing before them. They both pleaded the fifth. Hoffa has never been found, but he lives on. Again, here's Neil Rubin, a 40-year newspaper veteran.
Jimmy Hoffa's been missing since 1975, and he's still a tourist attraction here. It's like Six Flags Over Jimmy. The restaurant where he got stood up for a meeting, the places he's supposedly buried, the smelter where he was supposedly mixed with a batch of molten metal. I've been taken or been asked to take people to all of them.
If you've never lived near Detroit, this might seem hyperbolic. But I did live there for almost a decade, and for nearly 8 of those years, I worked as a Free Press reporter. In spring of 2006, we newshounds got word that there was a dig underway for Jimmy in the Milford area of Oakland County. We ran stories and briefs and aerial photographs of the dig site day after day. The early stories, of course, were written by my more established colleagues who had dealt with Hoffa headlines for years. If something were to be found, they wanted to be the ones writing about it. After a fruitless search, however, I got to write the nothing to see here story. It began like this. Quote, the 2-week search for Jimmy Hoffa has come to a close, so life will soon return to normal in the Oakland County village and township that was gripped by Hoffa fever. In downtown Milford, the Milford Baking Company has quit making the now notorious cupcakes with green plastic corpse hands poking through the dirt like chocolate topping. The buy one, get one Hoffa sale will end at Goody Two Shoes on Main Street. Even Lou and Ruby's on Milford Road will retire its specially brewed Hoffa Red, a lager you can dig. We've had our 15 minutes of fame, said Kay Phillip, 46, a 20-year Milford resident, as she bought 6 corpse hand cupcakes Tuesday. It's just been crazy. End quote. That story marked the ending of what had been, at that point, the largest search for Hoffa in years. It stuck with journalists like me who've covered it over the decades, sure. But it also has stuck with complete strangers, leading to stories like this one.
So the Maccas Red Fox was later bought and remodeled by a local chain called Andiamo's. And I had dinner there a year ago, and the waiter told me people still come in and want to sit at Jimmy Hoffa's table. He said he tries to tell them Hoffa didn't come inside that day, and they accuse him of being part of the cover-up.
It's a murder for which there's no end. The case, by the way, is still considered open by the FBI, who every so often, as Ruben said, quote, kind of roll the dice and dig a hole someplace and don't find him. Law enforcement doesn't like open cases, especially ones so public. And the places where the public at large seem to want to find him are, well, really far-reaching.
One of the dumb theories that won't go away is that Hoffa was buried beneath the football stadium where the New York Jets and New York Giants play. Come on, would you transport the body of a famous dead person all the way to New Jersey to get rid of it? And that's not just stupid, it's insulting. We can get rid of a dead body here. The same theory, there's nobody buried in the concrete at Hoover Dam. People fell in and died, but they had to dig them out and re-pour the cement because it won't set right if there's a person in there.
The thing is, he's still somebody in Detroit. Maybe it's not so important that he's found, but that his legend stays alive. But that, too, has a downside, as Ruben told Amy.
Jimmy and his wife, Josephine, had 2 kids, and you can imagine how tired they got of their dad's death being treated as a punchline. Barbara Crancer, the daughter, wound up being a judge in Missouri, and James P. Hoffa, the son, was also a lawyer. He did 5 5-year terms as Teamsters president. I was on a picket line in 1995. The newspapers were on strike here in Detroit. And James P. came by.
James P. is Hoffa's son.
With a pickup truck. And they'd outfitted the bed with a waterproof tarp and filled it with ice and a little bit of water. And there were cases of Fagel Pop, our local pop. And this was the middle of summer, probably August, actually. And along with the pop, there were a bunch of leftover Christmas-themed chocolate bars. And he was just driving by the picket lines and letting people get their fill. And I thought it was an incredibly thoughtful thing to do. And this is the president of the union, for heaven's sake. And he's out driving a pickup truck full of orange pop. If I'd ever learned to drive a truck, he'd have my vote.
That's a union guy talking, a Detroit guy. One who reminds that Hoffa and Detroit were made for each other. That kind of grit, that kind of fight, that kind of mystery. To research this story, journalist Amy Wilson read archival copies of Detroit newspapers surrounding the disappearance, as well as In Hoffa's Shadow by Jack Goldsmith and I Hear You Paint Houses by Charles Brandt. She also read various excerpts from Dan Modia's The Hoffa Wars and the FBI Hoffa Conference Report, January 27 and 28, 1975, and she interviewed the Detroit Free Press's Neil Rubin. Amber watched too many Senate hearings and a few WDIV Channel 4 specials to round things out. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoy. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.